Hello and welcome to another edition of Sight into Sound Presents. In this edition of Sight into Sound Presents, we'll talk to Bob Elder. Bob is a communication and investor education coordinator from the Texas State Securities Board in Austin. This informative interview was conducted by Sight into Sound volunteer Max Mowdy. They'll be discussing how to avoid scams. Every day we are barraged with scams coming from the internet, telephone, or maybe just someone walking up to you on the street, the shopping mall, or grocery store. They'll inform us on what questions to ask and all the warning signs we should look out for. On this edition of Sight into Sound Presents, How to Avoid Scams. I'm Jim Bratton. Welcome to another edition of Sight into Sound Presents. We're in Austin today. We are visiting with Bob Elder, who is the Communications and Investor Education Coordinator for the Texas State Securities Board. We really appreciate you being available to discuss scams, something that we are all subject to from time to time. You are with the Texas State Securities Board. And could you tell us a little bit about the Texas State Securities Board and its role as a state agency here in Texas?
Yes. First, thanks for having us to explain the Securities Board and our role in protecting investors in Texas. The State Securities Board has been around since 1957, and we regulate the securities industry in Texas in conjunction with federal authorities such as the Securities and Exchange Commission. Our largest division is law enforcement, where we investigate potential fraud that has come into us through tips, or we do undercover investigations, monitor advertisements, and other suspicious activity where people may be perpetrating investment fraud. It's our largest division with about 40% of our budget. And our attorneys regularly prosecute in local counties in conjunction with district attorneys. And at any given time, we have a number of attorneys designated as assistant U.S. attorneys to help in federal prosecutions of investment fraud.
So it sounds like you stay pretty busy watching what's going on in the state of Texas in conjunction with the federal regulators with respect to investment fraud.
Yeah, we do, and we're obviously, any agency that deals with investment fraud has a lot more on its plate than it can probably handle. How we regulate the industry in other ways is we have an inspections and compliance division, which goes out and conducts inspections of the books, records, and practices of the investment advisors and brokers that are under our particular jurisdiction, which is about 1,400. And we have a cycle where we get out there every 3 or 4 years to inspect firms to make sure that they're complying with our rules and regulations as well as the state's Security Act. So those are our primary functions at the Securities Board.
Before we talk specifically about scams and specific instances and examples, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and how, you know, your background, your experience, and how you came to join the Securities Board?
Yes, I was a reporter and editor for a number of publications for about 30 years before the better angels of my nature convinced me to go into public service. And I had worked for Texas Lawyer Magazine, Austin American Statesman, Wall Street Journal, Regional Economic Edition, a number of freelance publications or freelanced for a number of publications, some of which are still alive. But in this business, a lot have expired, unfortunately. But in my last 10, 12 years as a reporter, I was writing business stories and increasingly stories about investment fraud. So I thought it would be interesting to come to the other side of the fence, so to speak, and work on communications, investor education, and helping the agency prosecute fraud, detect fraud, and try to educate the public about how to avoid it, because its effects are absolutely devastating.
I don't recall the Securities Board having someone in your position, say, 20 years ago. Is this a relatively new position?
It is. It was newly created, and I came here about 7.5 years ago.
Do you conduct seminars from time to time, or do you address groups for educational purposes?
We do, and we have done it for a wide range of groups, civic groups, teacher organizations, veterans, teachers, public school teachers, senior citizen groups. We do a lot. So we do presentations, in many parts of the state, as well as provide our materials to groups. We have two publications. One is called A Salute to Smart Investing, and that is primarily for active military personnel. We also have a publication, The Veterans Handbook, Tactics for Civilian Life, which primarily addresses members of the military who are preparing for or have recently become civilians. And that book is more than simply investing advice and guidance. It deals with the GI Bill, searching for a job, housing, a range of issues that new veterans would face.
If someone wanted to receive a copy of that material, how would they go about doing that?
They would contact me at the Securities Board, and I can give the number if you'd like.
Yes, please.
My direct line is 512-305-8386, and my email is relder, which is R-E-L-D-E-R, at ssb.texas.gov.
You know, Bob, it sounds like the Securities Board, through you, is doing a lot more outreach to the public than it did at one time. Is that a correct statement? Is that a fair statement?
Yes, we have tried to ramp up our investor education efforts to a variety of groups, as I mentioned, and seniors, if we take one example, are a particular target of investment fraud, and we are simply trying to let seniors and other groups know how they can avoid falling into or stepping into a risky or fraudulent investment scheme. And we do tailor our message to different groups depending on what their interests are and where they are kind of in their life and financial picture.
I use the word scams and scam artists, although I hate to attach the word artist to a scam, because that's certainly something that I'm not sure that they are artists. They may be very good at what they do, but
I do as well, but some of these scams are so elaborate that I think it qualifies as artistry, unfortunately.
Unfortunately. You know, and also, when we were talking about this before, I have used the word scams as a generic term, but I think you were more correct when we were talking about this and discussing what we wanted to visit with about this morning, and that is there's real danger out there with respect to investment and investors and investment fraud and what we need to look for. Is there a definition of scams, or is it wrong to say it that there is a definition for the word so much as maybe it's an act or a method of conduct by people that are trying to harm someone financially?
Yes, I think it's mostly the latter. It might be helpful to explain exactly what a security is under the law and what we do regulate and don't regulate, because there's often some confusion, or simply people don't know about these issues.
Bob, one thing I think that as far as the listeners would not help is that exactly what you're pointing out, and that is there are different types of scams. There are tax scams, insurance scams. I mean, you can almost go down the list of anything that is part of our life today, and there may be some scammer out there that's trying to take advantage of it. In this instance, with the State Securities Board and you, as you correctly point out, the scams that we will be talking about relate to investment-type scams or dangerous situations which folks need to watch out for. Is that correct?
Yes, and there are securities, so we, for instance, would not regulate annuities, which aren't investment. That would fall under the Texas Department of Insurance.
Yes.
You know, a security is, though, broadly defined under Texas law, and if we can get a little technical for a moment.
Certainly.
It encompasses any investment in a business that is operated by someone other than the investor. The investor is passive. Somebody else is doing the investment work for them. And as I said, it includes a wide variety of securities. It could be a partnership in a business, a stock, a bond, any evidence of indebtedness, anything that represents an interest, for instance, in a oil, gas, or mining lease, investment contracts of many different varieties. So these are some of the investments that fall under the Texas Security Act and under the law and court decisions over the decades. It has come to be fairly broadly defined.
Have you seen scams operating in virtually all of these areas?
Yes, all these areas, and I believe we'll talk about some of the more common areas, but it is a broad range. The imagination of con artists knows no bounds.
Is there a method of communication that you see more widely used today than in the past that these con artists use to try to take advantage of us?
Social media really has been the weapon of choice for a lot of unscrupulous promoters, you know, for about a decade or so, and its danger really only grows. We monitor advertisements and online promotions through sites such as Facebook, LinkedIn, YouTube, Craigslist, if you can believe that. The Craigslist is a ground for some investment fraud, other online networks, and then the standalone websites that promoters may set up to try to entice the public to invest. But websites obviously give information that indicates something might be amiss, might be worth looking at a little more closely for fraud or inappropriate investments.
So you're finding that heretofore, they probably use the phone or email, but now they are definitely taking advantage, as you say, of the social media outlets and our what we use today.
Yeah. And they, you know, investment promoters can just as easily lie to and mislead investors online as they do in print. The apparent sophistication of a website or a social media channel are really meaningless. It does not matter how professional it may seem. Investors need to go to the underlying information that is presented. You know, the tried and true methods, email, cold calling, these boiler rooms that set up and people just continuously solicit investors over the phone for oil and gas investments, for instance, these are still common methods. And I guess a spam filter and hanging up the phone are probably the best defense against this. Cold calling is still quite prevalent.
Have you found that the scammers, are they usually men or women? You know, we might be more receptive if we hear a woman's voice or a woman presenting something as opposed to a man. But have you seen any, whether or not, both? I presume both men and women are very good at scamming people if they decide to do that.
Yes, they are. It's equal opportunity employment for some of these people. But we do see a number of scams perpetrated by both sexes, and it is not limited. We've had a recent prosecution, federal prosecution, we participated in where a former antiques dealer in LaGrange came up with a kind of an astonishing array of investment opportunities that she solicited people for. So we've had a number of cases. As I said, equal opportunity.
Are there particular targets that you're seeing today? Are they equally non-discriminatory in the target of people that scammers target?
A real focus of investment regulators, both in the federal level and the state level, are coming up with proposed rules and regulations and laws in Congress to try to protect senior investors. They continue to be one of the most common targets for fraud. And in general, it's because seniors have had longer careers, more time to save for retirement. Doesn't mean they're significantly wealthier than the rest of the population, but the odds are that they've been able to accumulate more assets over the decades. The senior fraud can be particularly devastating. At age 65, 70, or older, it's not likely that you're going to be able to recover the money you lost in an investment fraud. Job opportunities are not going to be there, and there's just not enough working years left to build up the account that you may have forfeited or lost through an investment scam. And it's particularly important to Texas. The U.S. population is aging. Texas, particularly so. In the decade that ended in 2010, Texas had three of the top 10 of national metro areas with the fastest growing population. Austin Round Rock was second in the nation, a 53% increase in seniors over that decade. Houston, Sugarland, Baytown was on that list, and Dallas, Fort Worth, Arlington. So this is a real issue on a number of levels, including financial fraud. The statistics show clearly that people who age, obviously, are more subject to cognitive impairment. And about half of the people who are in their 80s suffer from significant cognitive impairment, which really means they are incapable of making important financial choices. And investment-related skills, as well as others, just naturally decline as we age. So this increasing risk of the decline in cognitive abilities is a real danger for folks, and con artists know that. And it's particularly devastating, as I said. And people who take advantage of seniors or older people with some type of cognitive impairment, they're, you know, probably a special place in hell for those people.
Along with the education of all of us, including the seniors, with respect to scams and dangers that we should be alert to with respect to investments, that someone, as you're talking about, that's older, there must be some way that they can sense, and perhaps they don't, as you're pointing out, sense that who they're talking to or who is presenting them with some idea about investment, there's just something not quite right about that, and they should at least, before they do anything, talk to their son or their daughter or some other advisor that they know that they can trust before they write that check or send that money.
It's important to have a network around you, trusted family members, an accountant, a lawyer, anyone who can double check the investment opportunity that is coming to the person, and help them recognize the patterns of conduct that scam artists use. And some of the ones we see that are most common, a investment promoter will offer an opportunity that has unrealistic returns on your investment. And a little market history, financial history, if you know that, it goes a long way in protecting you from fraud. So the past 90 years, for instance, the stock market has returned about 10% a year. I don't know anyone who plans to invest for 90 years, but over that time frame, it shows you what the stock market has returned. Investment promoters will often promise guaranteed risk-free returns for a return of 20%, 30% a year. And this is by definition much riskier than most investments. Not only if you're promising 20 or 30% a year, which is twice or three times what the stock market has provided, the words guaranteed, safe, risk-free, complete protection of your principal, that is a sign almost certainly of a fraud or an investment that is extremely risky. And also, if you look at what the truly safe and secure investments are yielding these days, savings accounts, money market accounts, certificates of deposit for 1, 3, 5 years, you're getting squat on your investment. But if you look at that and you're getting 1%, 2% on these investments that are truly risk-free, backed by the federal government, FDIC, and so forth, 1%, 2%, somebody is offering you 20% that they say is risk-free. That doesn't happen. That's not possible. Another place another method by which investment promoters try to entice investors is to obscure important facts about the investment. One is to come up with a jumble of words that appear to make it seem like a sophisticated investment that is particularly complicated. And you know, any investment, the basics of it, you should be able to have it explained to you in 5 minutes. And if one of these investment promoters cannot explain one of these sophisticated sounding investments clearly, state the fees, how the investment promoter will be paid, how your returns are going to be paid to you, then that is also red flag for investors. You know, clarity on all these issues, the fees, how the investment's going to be structured, these are things that really need to be clearly explained to an investor. You know, and another method is an investment promoter telling you that you need to act now. This opportunity is going away quickly. You need to invest today. You know, an investment should not be hawked like steak knives on an infomercial. You know, in investing, there's always another day to consider the investment and really think it through. Investors should not be pressured by that kind of talk and make a quick decision that they will, in all likelihood, regret.
Bob, I really appreciate you presenting these flags, if you will, or points that whenever we hear someone talk in a certain manner, say certain things, pressure us in any way, that's when the red flag should go up and we should sit back and, as you say, talk to our circle of advisors, family members, or whoever before we do anything. Could we go ahead and speak to some specific examples which you and the Securities Board are seeing as scams or possible dangerous situations and communications to us that should raise these flags? Some what you're seeing out there today is going on in the investment world and here in Texas.
One method that we see grounds where investment fraud takes hold is what we call affinity fraud. And that can be done through a civic group, a social club, a place of worship, where you trust the people you are, for instance, worshiping with. If they bring you an investment opportunity, many people are more likely to listen to and trust that person. And then you get one person investing, another, and finally you get a large group of people investing, and it may turn out to be a Ponzi scheme where the later investors are just funneling in money to pay the investors who got in early. And that further spreads the scam, because if you're an early investor in that and you get your returns, you are more likely to tell more people about it. But your investments are coming from the newer investors. They are just, the investment promoters just using that later money to pay the early investors, so it perpetuates itself. So eventually, Ponzi schemes will collapse, though.
So this affinity group is someone, so people, it's coming from people that you already have a trust or a relationship with, which where your guard goes down, and you just automatically assume what they're suggesting to you is a good idea.
Yes, and we've had a number of cases in this regard. We had a case a few years ago where we assisted in a federal prosecution and had investigated this individual earlier and taken administrative action against him. And he had solicited members of his Mormon church congregation as the early money for what eventually became a $50 million investment fraud. Perhaps the top investor threat is dealing with an unregistered individual. It's really a three-story tall red flag for investors. In Texas, if you are selling a security or advising people on securities, you need to be registered. You need to be registered with the state of Texas. And if you are dealing with someone who is not registered, and selling what apparently is a security, that person is not someone you want to deal with on a financial opportunity. And it is, we'll go in later, into later on how to check to see if people are registered, and if they are, to get a lot of background information on them. The members of the public, unfortunately, do not think about the registration of people who sell securities. You know, a plumber has to be licensed, a cosmetologist, a property tax consultant, companies that recycle used auto parts. All these people and entities have to be registered. And it would stand to reason that someone selling you an investment should also be licensed. I mean, if you get into a financial scam and make a bad financial move, that's going to hurt you a lot longer than a bad dye job that a cosmetologist did.
Absolutely.
On you. So people selling securities do need to be registered. Dealing with an unregistered person can be trouble.
Do you run into the same situation with respect not only to people that are selling securities, but also people that want to advise with respect to money management and that kind of thing? Or you see a spillover by some advisors that are actually scammers in selling their investment advisory services?
Well, the vast majority, I think, in Texas and nationwide of investment advisors and brokers are honest people working to help their clients. But we do and have taken actions against registered investment advisors and brokers for a number of things that violated the Securities Act or the Texas State Securities Board rules and regulations. We recently revoked the registration of an investment advisor from Dallas for withdrawing grossly excessive fees from one of her clients' accounts. So things of that nature will result in a revocation. There are also administrative orders that can suspend an advisor or broker for a number of months. There are fines levied against individuals and financial firms for misconduct.
If I'm sitting and talking to somebody on the phone, I presume I can say, are you licensed with the Securities Board in Texas to sell this security? Most people probably won't do that. Could you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yes. If you are, as I said, you need to be registered to sell securities, And if you are talking to an individual and asking the question that you just posed, that person may not be registered, but may come up with explanations of why they don't have to be registered. Those, for an unlicensed, unregistered individual, those explanations are usually bogus, but some promoters are able to talk their way past the registration question, which makes it important to call or otherwise contact the State Securities Board. And if you have a question about registration, you can call toll-free 1-888-663-0009. And you can also go to our main website, which is ssb.texas.gov. If you request a background report on an investment advisor or broker or broker-dealer, it's done anonymously, of course. The broker or financial advisor is not told that someone is checking up on them, but you will get a background report that lists, if the person is registered, it will list the work history, what licenses the person holds, what their other professional designations are. For instance, if they're a chartered financial analyst or a certified financial planner, and it will go into any disciplinary action that person has faced, including complaints by customers, what the resolution of that complaint was, whether it was settled without any blame assessed on the advisor, or whether there was restitution that the person had to pay. If there are any criminal actions, those will be listed. Of course, many criminal actions would stop a person from being registered, but if there was a very old case for a minor offense, let's say, the person can probably overcome that to be registered. So that is the primary way, two ways. One, check to see if the person is registered, and if they are, check to see their background. You may see things in there that you don't like that may cause you to question the individual further. Bankruptcies are also listed in these areas. So if you had one or two personal bankruptcies, that may give a person pause. Or there may be reasonable explanations for these bankruptcies. The point is that you have the information to make your own judgment if someone is registered. If they are not registered, you may make a judgment in another direction simply to not deal with that individual. Why take that risk?
Are there other things that you see out there that you all are seeing today that either whether it's who's trying to scam us or how they're trying to scam us?
Yeah, promissory notes are a real issue for us in prosecution and detecting fraud. Promissory note is basically an IOU. You know, I owe you $10 max. The problem is that promissory notes have become they've spread to cover a large range of investments. So someone might sell a promissory note, an investment contract, to cover, to fund everything from property development to oil and gas exploration or to buy interests in a business partnership. And the promissory note says you will invest this, you will get a return, but these promissory notes often are used, the money is raised to cover very risky investments that the investor really does not know a lot about. Do we know a lot about the business partnership in which we are investing? Do we really know much about oil and gas exploration? I've lived in Texas for a long time. I'm a student of history. I know a fair amount about oil and gas development. I would be very hesitant to invest anything in that because it is so complicated. And related to that are high-yield investment programs, something that promises, again, a safe and secure return, but at a rate that will dwarf what we are getting, as I mentioned, on these money market accounts or CDs. And they are usually high-yield investment programs are usually sold for businesses, again, which we may not be familiar with. And investors in these high-yield programs really do not have the skill to evaluate the credit worthiness or the prospects of this business or project that is supposed to generate enough revenue to pay the promised returns on these notes. And, you know, experienced people have trouble deciphering these particularly complicated businesses. As a regular investor, we just do not have the skills to evaluate the businesses that are supposed to generate these high yields for us. In many of these cases, the investment opportunities are very complicated. We had a case in Hood County where the individual received a sentence of 85 years, and he sold promissory notes in insurance holding companies and other companies. It was a complete fraud. He did not put any money into these companies. They barely existed, and the promissory notes, these investment contracts, supposedly would have given investors shares in this insurance company and allowed them to participate in the profits of that company. But a lot of the money was just used for his personal expenses, his wife's personal expenses. He also used investor money to make payments to his criminal defense lawyer. That's chutzpah, the definition of it.
It is.
And in that case, he took money from an elderly woman who had some cognitive impairment. She invested $117,000 with this individual and lost it all. And we unfortunately have a number of cases where elderly investors lose the bulk of their life savings.
Is it a fairly general, correct statement that it's rare if anyone can recover the money once it's gone to a scammer?
It is, and we try to make that clear at the beginning when people file complaints, suggest an investment that they've made that they believe should be prosecuted criminally. It's rare that it's even a few cents on the dollar. We have had a couple of cases where we have been able to recover 50, 60, 70 cents on the dollar. Those are rare. If you lose your money in what you suspect is a fraud, it's very likely gone forever because fraud, con artists will spend that money on anything you can think of, a Bentley, rare guitars, a luxury skybox at the Texas DKR Memorial Football Stadium that we can see from this office.
You've actually seen it. These are examples of how money has been spent.
No, absolutely. Someone bought a Picasso, you know, $40,000 hunting rifles. All these luxury cars, Bentleys, Lamborghinis, you name it, they are buying it, and these items are paid for by investors. Think about if you're putting money in an investment, how would you feel if that investment was really going toward buying a Lamborghini or a rare Les Paul Gibson guitar? And these are some of the things that have been auctioned off to try to repay investors, but the total sum of the money that is repaid, if it is repaid, is, as I said, just a few cents on the dollar. These criminals can buy anything you can think of. It's all gravy for them. Really funds a extraordinary lifestyle for some of these folks.
Are there other examples that you can share with us this morning?
Oil and gas is a particular and persistent problem for us. Some of it may stem from Texans' general knowledge that Texas is a heavy oil and gas producing state. The economy here was built on oil and gas development. There is a sense that it is a sure thing in investing in oil and gas. But the interests that are sold in oil and gas development, if the wells even exist, mm-hmm. which they don't sometimes, is that they're highly speculative and complex. It is not simply a matter of giving money to someone. Drilling comes out of the ground, and you are paid from that investment. The investments are structured in a very complex way, and it's difficult to investigate a promoter's claims about how much oil and gas will be produced, the time it takes to start production, and as I said, how the investment is structured, because that's going to affect revenue and potential profits. And think about investing in oil and gas as opposed to a large U.S. company or a mutual fund that invests in large U.S. companies. You know what large companies do, by and large. You, in an oil and gas project, likely don't have the expertise to decipher geological maps, production reports, things of that nature.
Have you found that also oil and gas, someone may be approached with the idea that, well, we're not drilling a well, that's too risky. What we're doing is buying royalty or buying leases or something like that, which is much less risky, and the royalty is, you know, the well's going to produce a royalty to all of us, et cetera, and you can participate in that. Is that, that's another little nuance, isn't it, to oil and gas investing or promotions?
Yes, royalty interests are sold in a lot of oil and gas drilling projects. In many instances, the projects are not undertaken or developed to the extent that the investment promoter says they would be. And in many cases, they simply turn out not to exist. And these are some of the same risks are presented by royalty interests that they are from other types of oil and gas development. We had an attorney up in Frisco in North Texas who stole $1.3 million by selling royalty interests that in some cases, at least two cases that he sold, turned out not to exist. And he spent a lot of money on his personal expenses. And as the royalty interest money began to dwindle, he took some of it and invested in a coal mine in West Virginia to try to recoup and get revenue generated that might satisfy investors, and shuffled a lot of money around through different accounts.
And again, I'm sure in oil and gas and all these other investments, as you had mentioned previously, a lot of those are subject to Ponzi scheme type of arrangements where the original investors are not really receiving money from the investment, but they're receiving money that he's bringing in as new investors to pay the old investors the return or close to it that he had originally promised. Yeah. And then those investors, he's got to get more investors to come in to pay the middle group of investors, etc. And that is the Ponzi scheme. That's the daisy chain there that where if somebody calls us and says, you know, we want you to invest in this oil and gas deal or whatever, I write the check, money goes to them. My money may never go to the oil and gas project at all. It may go to pay other investors who were defrauded to begin with.
And if you are getting a return, if you are an early investor in these projects, you're happy, because you're getting your money, but you're not realizing where it's coming from. And unless an investment promoter can line up an endless supply of investors, the Ponzi scheme will collapse, as all of them do. And as these things go into litigation often, there will be legal action, clawbacks, as they're called, to try to recover money from those early investors who have actually made money from this. So that is a real danger for investors as well, the early investors who have had their alleged profits returned to them.
Are there any others you would like to discuss with us on specific scams or dangerous situations we need to be aware of?
Yeah, real estate is an increasingly common one for us. Maybe we can blame all these shows that renovation, flipping,
exactly,
whatever they are. Real estate investing for us is not flipping houses on your own to rent them, just something you're doing for fun and profit, supposedly. I think there's a lot of headaches involved in that as well. But real estate opportunities are often sold through investment contracts, notes, and other securities. So examples in this would include a investment that involves the purchase, rehabilitation, and sale of distressed houses and other property, the purchase of mortgage notes and real estate assets, development of shopping centers, for instance, and other real estate projects. Often, an investment promoter in real estate will try to calm investors' nerves by saying a project has minimal risk because it is backed by a quote-unquote hard asset. But if an investment opportunity, the project does not develop that hard asset, then there's really no security for an investor. A lot of things affect that. The ability to sell or refinance a property. Property valuations fluctuate depending on the economy and what part of the state you may be in. And if you're renting properties and getting money that way, your revenue could be affected by inventory and how many competing apartment projects are being built. There are a lot of ways that real estate can go wrong. And a lot of promoters of real estate investments claim that they have this special expertise and experience in the area that guarantees an investor is going to get robust returns. But these claims should not be taken at face value, just like any claim an investment promoter makes.
Have you ever seen a situation where a licensed real estate salesperson, agent, promotes these types of investments, and if the question comes up, are you licensed to do this, they will say yes, meaning they're licensed as a real estate agent or broker, but they're not licensed as a securities salesman.
Yes, and that's the Real Estate Commission regulates those individuals if you just have license to sell houses as a realtor, but if that person goes beyond and starts selling securities with investment contracts, let's say for the types of development we just discussed, then they need an additional license, and that's from this agency,
yes,
to sell securities. We do find, though, that the bulk of these real estate scams are perpetrated by people who are unlicensed and not registered in any capacity. And it makes sense if you're going to pull off a scam, be bold enough to do that. Why get registered in the first place?
Why bother?
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
Are there any others that you would like to share with us?
I'll just go through a few others quickly. One we've seen recently in this agency that we've investigated and taken action on are pension advance scams. If you are getting a pension as a retiree from the state, or the teacher retirement system, the federal government, military, you have a stream of income coming in. And people will offer to buy that stream of income and put it in investments that will give you a better return than the income you're getting from your pension. You know, people should think very carefully about doing anything with a stream of income that comes from a state, a corporation, teacher retirement system here in Texas, because those are a defined regular benefit that is guaranteed for life. And people should think very carefully about selling the rights to that. And in many cases, it is illegal to acquire certain rights. And veterans and disabled persons are among those who are targeted to try to sell, enticed to sell their benefits. And these individuals may be solicited when they're in financial distress, and they will sell their future benefit payments at a significant reduction in their actual value. We see cases in foreign exchange trading. Trading in foreign currencies requires a tremendous amount of expertise. It is very hard to make money at it. And we've had cases where the investment promoters had no license of any kind to trade foreign currencies. You know, and even if investors are inclined to take a flyer in Forex investments, they really have to ask themselves if you're comfortable committing a significant amount of money to something that is so risky and requires expertise that the individual selling the investment may not have.
Something we see a lot of today, and that are people that are promoting the sale of gold and silver. I'm sure that there are very legitimate dealers in metals, but there are also people where that is I'm sure that is an area that is subject to scammers.
We do not regulate those kind of transactions per se, but we do see scams that involve a variety of commodities where a person will claim to be investing in gold, silver, other commodities, and pooling money for those investments to make money for investors. And those do fall into the area of securities. You know, the guidance I might give investors in these one-on-one gold transactions from dealers of gold is simply, if you want to sell your gold for a profit, who do you sell it to? If you have a mutual fund, you can sell that in a week. You may get less money, you may get more, but it is liquid. You can simply sell a mainstream security. If you have physical gold and you want to get rid of it, let's say you've made a profit or the price of gold has gone up, where do you sell it? Some people who acquire it back from you may have a hefty commission to take it back. So you really need to know what you are going to do with this asset if you wish to sell it.
This has been extremely helpful and enlightening. Assuming that we suspect either by the sound of a bell going off in our head or a red flag that the person is basically trying to scam us, and we talk to our son, daughter, family, friends, whoever that are trusted advisors to us before we take any action. One of the things we can always do is hang up the phone. Do not interact in any way with someone scamming us on a social media. Those are some of the things we can do, basically, just shut it off at the source and say, I'm not interested, etc. How do you see most people successfully basically shut these things down?
By the methods you had mentioned, there is always a good idea to shut down these cold calls that are coming. There's a lot of, if you get to a certain age, which I believe we qualify, when you cross 50, you are getting a lot of invitations to free lunch and dinner seminars. And a lot are done by registered individuals. But it's important to realize that some can be fraudulent or inappropriate investments, and you will be getting a hard sell follow-up if you attend one of these free lunch or dinner seminars.
Yes.
It's probably ultimately cheaper to eat elsewhere. And the other is to recognize some of the signs that we discussed earlier, unreasonably high returns. Asking the person, are you registered? If they give an explanation about why they don't have to be, then the next contact should be the Texas State Securities Board to check that answer. And if they're selling what appear to be investments, securities, most likely they are trying to pull the wool over your eyes.
And again, if I could ask for that phone number, please, just so that our listeners will know who to call and if they have a suspected scam situation.
Yes, the number is 888-663-0009. And on the website, we have a complaint form in English and Spanish. The information that we typically ask for is, you know, the exact name of the account holder, what investment was involved, the name of the salesperson or company who sold you the product, chronological list of events starting with the initial contact by the company, and then a significant amount of documentation that you believe might be relevant, statements, letters, forms, applications, and give us a explanation of how you believe the situation should be rectified. And there is a intake process, and the complaints are dealt with from that intake process. And information, generally speaking, that's provided to the State Securities Board as part of a complaint is confidential.
Good.
In certain instances, parts of the complaint may be sent to the individual that's being complained about in terms of trying to resolve it or get a response. The initial complaint, though, is confidential, but if it goes to an investigation or if it ends up in litigation, obviously there's a fair amount of information that could be divulged. And again, unfortunately, what we will tell people is that investors rarely recover significant portions of their losses. That is a sad fact. And if there are groups that are interested in having a speaker on some of these topics or material that we publish, parts of our website that may be of interest, anyone can call me at 512-305-8386.
Bob, thank you again.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you to Sight and Sound volunteer Max Mowdy for conducting this interview, and special thanks to Bob Elder, Communication and Investor Education Coordinator from the Texas State Securities Board in Austin, for taking time out of his busy schedule to be interviewed and providing us with such valuable information. If you feel that you or someone you know is a victim of a scam, please contact Bob Elder from the Texas State Securities Board in Austin at 512-305-5386. That's 512-305-8386. Also, if you would like a CD copy of this show or would just like to hear it again, you can visit the Listen on Demand page at our website, sightintosound.org. Sight into Sound Presents is a production of Sight into Sound Radio. Your producer was Jim Martinez. I'm Jim Bratton.